capitalism is great at building wealth and is not a system designed to distribute wealth. But it's still a better judge at distributing wealth than some useless, incompetent bureaucrat or politician that has never worked a single day in his life.
Is about more than just a regular gym routine. When was the last time you checked on your financial fitness? If you're feeling like you're falling behind, Ed Sedell is here to help with The Retirement Trainer, a podcast about helping you get into better financial shape. Every week, Ed talks about things you need to know to become more financially fit for your future. Learn about things like how much money will you need, financial mistakes other people often make, and how you can avoid them. Plus, details on The Retirement Fitness Plan, a plan Ed personally created to help you get to and through retirement by focusing on five key areas of your financial life. Learn more about The Retirement Fitness Plan when you visit egsifinancial.com and click on Processes. Then subscribe, follow, and listen to The Retirement Trainer on Apple Podcasts, your iHeart app, or whichever podcast platform you prefer.
It is an honor to have you back on the podcast this morning. Thank you very much for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Faber, you are the publisher and editor of the Gloom, Boom, and Doom Report. You are an expert with the economy globally as well as the U.S. And so we have an awful lot of questions for you. If you don't mind, give me your perspective from a macroeconomic point of view of not just the U.S., but the global economy and kind of what you're seeing.
Well, thank you for having me on your program. And if you ask me about the global economy, it's difficult to measure the global economy because countries, they calculate the GDP figures, then they think that GDP tells you anything, but actually GDP doesn't say very much about the standards of living of the majority of people. I mean, if we have a society as a leader, the leaders should aim at lifting the standards of living of the majority of people and their well-being, I mean, in every respect. Whereas at the present time, it seems to me that the standards of living of the super rich have been lifted, middle class, and the lower classes, their standards of living are going pretty much down everywhere in the world.
Right.
Because their cost of living is rising more than their salaries are increasing. So it's not a healthy situation for the majority of people, but for the few super rich, as you know, last year, the stock market was up massively. And if you held gold or assets in general, you did well, except with commercial properties, they were down. But in general, the asset holders did very well over the last 40 years, whereas the working class has been losing out, period. Now, the government doesn't tell you that because they need the votes to get elected and so forth. And they always want to pretend that they actually do something for the people when in reality they do something for themselves. But specifically about the global economy, I mean, I still travel and I see the business environment here in Thailand and in the rest of Asia. And I follow the developments in Europe and the U.S. very closely. In general, I would say that if you take the whole period of, say, the post-war years, the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, 80s, 90s, and up to now, we had a strong growth until about the 1965-70 period. And thereafter, growth slowed down. But we kept growth by borrowing more. So the government debts in all the Western democracies as a percentage of the economy grew significantly, and we are more indebted than ever before. And the economies, they kept on growing in terms of, as I said, in GDP, but the standards of living of most people didn't improve much in America or even went down. And in other countries, there has been massive progress in the country that mostly criticized the Western media, and that is China. If you take the standards of living of people in China in 1980 and today, you can't compare it. I mean, it's become a modern country in those 40 years, but that is not recognized by the journalists and the Western governments for whatever reason. But there has been huge progress in some countries, in emerging economies, that went from a system of socialism and communism to a free market and to the adoption of the capitalistic system. I mean, there's no question the whole of Eastern Europe is much better off than, say, before the Iron Curtain fell in 1989. So there has been improvement in the world, but per capita level of prosperity, I'd say the peak we reached was 2018, 2019. Then came COVID, the break-in, and then there was a recovery. But in most economies, we're not above the 18-19 peak. We've recovered, and some statistics show that maybe we even exceeded the 18-19 peak. But the reality, you look at, say, housing construction in the U.S., it's lower than in the 70s. You look at car sales, they've been flat to down for the last 10 years. So for me, if you ask me how is the global economy, it's kind of humming along, but it's not much of a progress. The country is doing well. Everybody has to eat, enough to eat, because we have a small population relative to the agricultural wealth. So there's no shortages of food. But the country is considered by many economists as a failed state. It's actually funny, and this I want to point out in economics, there are all sorts of definitions and so forth. Officially, Thailand is a failed state.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at the number of tourists that come to Thailand, and they all say that it's a wonderful country for traveling and it's safe, nobody will ever attack you in Thailand and that, unless you steal the girlfriend of the mafia boss. That is not a very good thing to do anywhere in the world.
Right.
And also, so many people come and retire here. Then I ask myself, what is the definition of a failed state? Maybe people want to go and live in a failed state because what they, the media and the governments in the Western world and all these useless elected bureaucrats say or designate as a failed state, maybe it's a state that actually functions better than the organized state, full of regulation and controls and laws nobody understands clearly.
That's a very valid point, right? All these regulations. So has your perspective changed at all since Donald Trump's election and actually inauguration? We're still not even a full 2 weeks into it. His plan for deregulation, do you think that that's going to have a positive effect or not have an effect at all on the economy?
In general, it would be difficult to find a worse president than Mr. Biden was and his administration. I mean, the administration of Biden is an administration that took on huge amounts of debts. And under his presidency, and I'm not making him 100% responsible for it, but partly responsible at least, is under him, inflation accelerated significantly and the business climate deteriorated significantly. So in that respect, of course, I'm in favor of having Trump. He creates a more favorable business environment. But anybody would have done that.
Well, you know what? That's a very true statement, and I agree with that.
But now the other thing is, as you know, on Friday, he announced a number of tariffs.
Yes, that was my next question.
I've been looking at these tariffs. In general, he's crazy. It's a horrible idea to impose tariffs on Canada and Mexico and China. It will increase the cost of living for the ordinary American. It will depress asset markets because the other countries will react to it. And to impose tariffs on Canada is crazy because Canada supplies the U.S. with oil, over 4 million barrels a day.
Mm-hmm.
They supply the whole East Coast with electricity. It's actually a country that can do something about tariffs.
So do you think that the tariffs are more for a negotiating standpoint? Obviously, they've already been imposed. We're seeing the effects on the market today, you know, here out the Dow, the S&P, and the NASDAQ here in the U.S. But do you think that it is a designed for negotiation, or do you think these are ways to help cover the cost of government spending?
I mean, this is a good question because a tariff is basically a tax, but nobody knows exactly who pays the tax. Is it a Canada that pays the tax or the American consumer by paying higher prices and so forth? Mm-hmm. That, as an economist, we don't know precisely. This depends on the elasticity of demand and supply.
Right.
These are all economic terms that you learn at school when you study economics. I don't believe so much in them, but it is true that any tax that you impose can be rolled over. So it's not sure who will pay the tax, the tariffs. In my view, the American consumer will pay a large portion by paying higher prices for goods and services they could have obtained at a cheaper price. Do you understand that the difficulty of tariffs, and that's why they're so destructive,
mm-hmm.
is that, say, you're an American auto company. Where do you auto parts come from? They come from China. So,
because we don't manufacture anything here. You're absolutely right.
You understand? You have to calculate very carefully. And this is what I'm arguing about. Trump, in principle, he would be a good president.
Mm-hmm.
But sadly, he's an incredible interventionist. An interventionist is someone who thinks he knows better than anybody else. So he takes economic policy measures without having a clear view of what the benefits and the damages will be. Nobody knows for sure. In my view, this tariffs and trade war is a horrible idea, a horrible idea. And it has now wiped out a substantial amount of capital in the world's financial markets. And it will continue to do so, in my opinion. And it will reduce business activity. And it may lead to a depression.
Wait, all right, so expand on that. Because right now, he's just talking about tariffs on Mexico, Canada, and an extra 10% on China. So when you say a depression, global depression, is that just based on tariffs with those countries, or if he continues to expand the tariffs against all countries?
I don't know. There are some countries that export to the U.S., but it's insignificant.
Mm-hmm.
The significant exporters are largely Asian exporters and Mexico and Canada and so forth. But this is the difficulty of tariffs. Say a Chinese company owns a factory in Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and it's under the Vietnamese law. It's a Vietnamese company. Now, the U.S. is keen to have close relationships with Vietnam. Will they impose tariffs on Vietnam? Probably less than on China, you understand? But the Chinese company, they can send goods to Vietnam, or they can increase the production in Vietnam, and so forth. And so, and then the U.S., or Trump, doesn't realize that actually the U.S. depends on a lot of services and goods from China. So the Chinese can also impose tariffs. Plus, the Chinese, they look at trade from a different perspective than the U.S. They say General Motors and these companies, the multinationals, they produce in China, okay? Then they export to the U.S., but they also sell to the domestic market in China. The Chinese calculate these sales of foreign companies in China to the Chinese market. Say Nike produces shoes and they sell them in China. They consider this as an import of China of American produced goods because it's Nike, although the factory is in China.
Mm-hmm.
And so they look at this differently. But what I want to say is the Chinese can do a horrible damage to these foreign companies that operate in China.
I do not disagree, but do you think if we kind of look at it bigger picture, the tariffs, and I agree with a lot of what you're saying, but a lot of these countries have closed their markets to the U.S. or they're already imposing significant tariffs to the U.S. So do you think it's more of a situation where it's got to be more of a fair trade? So we already know, like you said, with China, even though they're produced domestically, it's still considered imported. So there's tariffs on all those goods and services from the U.S. into the China.
But not much, not high tariffs.
How about U.S. autos in Europe and the tariffs imposed there? Are we looking at it more of, okay, should it be fair all the way across the board? If you want access to our markets, you know, we need to have the same type of access to your markets.
Look, I don't know the details of every country,
mm-hmm.
but it would seem to me that, say, American products in Europe are very competitively priced, unless the production cost is much higher in America. But I don't think the duties make a lot of difference. I don't think there are duties on many American goods in Switzerland, for example. But I don't know the details everywhere. It may be true, or there may be some truth, that foreign products can be imported into the U.S. at lower tariffs than foreign goods imported into emerging markets like, say, Indonesia or Thailand and so forth. That may be true. But one thing I want to tell you, American policymakers don't understand, or they don't want to understand. The fact is simply that China can produce most goods cheaper than the U.S. can. I mean, I have statistics about electric cars. Their cars are of better quality and at about a quarter of the price of an electric car in the U.S. What do you want to do? You want to make these foreign cars uncompetitive by imposing huge tariffs on them? Or do you want to benefit the population in America that can buy a car at a much lower price than General Motors and Ford can produce? What do you want? As an economist, I'm telling you, the best for the majority of people is to get these Chinese cars into the U.S. at a much lower price than the GM and Ford electric cars and Teslas.
So why do you think they're able to produce it at such a significantly lower price, at such a discount as compared to the U.S.?
Part of the reason is technology. They're advanced. We've seen that now with DeepSeek, if you don't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a slap in the face of American technology companies that the Chinese upstart can produce something this inexpensively.
And I do agree with technology to a certain point, but labor, the cost of labor, I mean, obviously that has to play a huge part in those products.
Labor is a very small component in every manufacturing company.
Okay.
In most companies, they operate with robots. The labor is maybe maximum 5% of the cost of production in America and in Europe, especially, say, in Germany. Germany was considered the Wirtschaftswunder, the miracle, the economic miracle post-Second World War, because they grew rapidly and so forth. Now we have a government in Germany, and this has to be said, consisting of communists and socialists that are green. What they mean by green, I don't know, since they decided to dismantle nuclear power plants, which is the cleanest energy you can produce in the world.
Right.
The greens. It shows you what kind of people they are. They are not market-oriented, capitalistic people. And I'm not saying that capitalism is the optimal system in every respect, but it's the best system to enrich the country. I don't know any other system that can lift the standards of living of the world as they have done in the last 50 years. The world has never enjoyed in history a period where the king was eating the same food as the poorest people and drinking the same Coca-Cola bottle as the poorest people. This is an unusual state for the world, that we've reached this prosperity. And we didn't reach it because of socialism. I've been since the 1950s in socialist countries. I could, as a child, right away see how come these people are so poor compared to the Western world? How come they are so behind in everything, in every respect, compared to what we had in Western Europe? And then when I was a student, I was racing for the ski team. I traveled frequently to Eastern Europe. We were always surprised how poor they were and how badly equipped they were. So, and then I went, of course, to China early on. I remember the first visits to China. I thought this was going into a nightmare. Well, my first visit to Russia was in 1918. They had markets. There were people lining up to buy rotten tomatoes and rotten potatoes. Horrible. Lines of people. And the destitution that you saw is unbelievable. And then the socialists, they are the children of rich people. They come and tell the world that capitalism is a failure. No, it's not a failure. But there are disadvantages. Capitalism is great at building wealth and is not a system designed to distribute wealth. Actually, it's system designed to make the successful very successful because it's sort of the survival of the fittest. And you eliminate the unproductive companies and so forth. But it's still a better judge at distributing wealth than some useless, incompetent bureaucrat or politician that has never worked a single day in his life, including members of the Federal Reserve. That is the problem, that these people that tell how to run a country have never been in a business, have never worked a single day in their lives, except going to universities that are teaching them useless ideologies of Karl Marx.
Well, and that's exactly what it is. It's ideology and theories, and they're not practical. And we actually saw that over the last 4 years that you were just talking about, Dr. Faber. We saw a continued disparity between the haves. The wealthier got wealthier, and the middle class and the working poor struggled more and more. It's almost literally a tale of two cities. So do you see anything right now? Because obviously the markets were affected. Do you see anything that's looming right now, a crisis?
Yes, I want to tell you what I see. I distinguish between consumer price inflation and asset inflation. Let's say we print money, which the Federal Reserve does, and we have deficits. The deficits and the money printing is unquestionably inflationary, unquestionably. Now, it's well established. Now, the inflation, when it touches consumer good prices, they call it inflation because the housewives go shopping and they see the price of wheat going up. Last year, they saw the price of cocoa going up, of chocolate. Here, they see the price of coffee that's quadrupled last year, right, and so forth. Then they bitch, you know, that they're not happy. The asset inflation is when house prices go up, the price of a house goes up, or the price of stocks goes up, or bond prices rally as interest rates decline and so forth. This we call asset inflation, but usually it's called a bull market in homes, bull market in stocks, or bull market in bonds. And in general, it is welcome by the majority of people and the media. They love it. Because the strange thing about inflation is that the things that cause inflation are popular. Distributing subventions, tariffs, and so forth and so on, and the evil China and the evil Russia and evil Iran and so forth. All the expenditures relating to that are popular. But the consequences of these measures are inflationary. That is not popular. When the prices in the department stores go up and so forth, when your electricity bill goes up, you're not very happy. When the taxes go up, you're not very happy, you know, and so forth. So it's a very complex issue. That's why it's also difficult to bring inflation down. Because to bring inflation down, you can do it. You don't print money anymore. But then you have some disruptions in the economy. Because the economy is used to asset inflation. So let's say you have a house. It's worth $500,000. 5 years later, it's worth $1,000,000. You feel richer, you spend more money. And many people go and borrow more money. The house is suddenly worth that much more. My suspicion is the asset market inflation, the bull market in stocks, and the favorable conditions in the bond market until 2020. As you know, since 2020, interest rates have gone up. Mm-hmm. But the rich people actually benefit from higher interest rates because the poor people have credit card debts. They have car loans. The rich people don't have that. They have deposits, including myself. I benefit from rising interest rates.
Yes.
When I'm talking this way, I'm talking as an economist and as a social observer. Don't misunderstand me. As a personal investor, I benefit from money printing. The price of gold goes up. My portfolios go up. I'm very happy. I should actually send a bonus to Jerome Powell at the Fed that they keep on printing money. But under Trump, I can assure you, money will be printed. That for sure.
So you think under Trump, it's going to be more inflationary or inflationary as it was under Biden?
More inflationary.
Really?
So whether the rate will go up to, I mean, I don't know where rates will go up to, but I think eventually the interest rates and the inflation rate will be higher than in 1979, 1980. And at that time, the 10-year Treasury was yielding up to 15.84%. And I remember I had deposits at 20% per annum, 20%. The bond yield now is, at a very low level relative to the price increases. There's an economist in the United States who calculates the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, according to the old methodology. In other words, he doesn't make the adjustments that the Fed has done and the Bureau of Labor Statistics. His inflation figure is up over 10.6% per annum at the present time.
Wow.
I think 10% is maybe on the high side, but I can tell you, every American I meet will tell me that if the government says the inflation is 2.6%, it's all bullshit. Nonsense. Nobody believes that.
You are right.
Every household thinks costs are going up by 10% per annum or something like this. I have seen insurance premiums of people, they sent it to me, where in 3 years, the cost of the insurance goes up 100%. And then the government has the audacity. The next book should be The Audacity of Lies by the Government. Yes, The Audacity of Lies is they claim that healthcare costs have come down in the last 3 years.
Yeah.
I've never heard of any the medical bill that has come down in my life. Never.
No. It's only going in one direction and it's been straight up.
It's up.
Yep.
But you understand, the people that are always on TV and so forth and in government, they have lost their common sense. In that respect, I'm happy that we have Trump. At least he has some common sense. The big question is who controls him? Because as you know, the deep state has not vanished. be still there. And who controls Trump? That is the big question. And to what extent he can be controlled.
Well, let's just do one, the simplest one. What, not as simple, but Doge, right? To cut government costs. Do you think he's actually going to be able to even come close to his goals as far as reducing those costs?
No, because most of the government expenditures are mandatory expenditures. I mean, you can't fiddle around Social Security. You can't cut it. And the Veteran Administration, you know, in the Army, maybe they find a legal way, but most likely not. So the discretionary expenditures of the government in the U.S. out of the $7 trillion expenditures annually is maybe $1 trillion. This is discretionary spending. Of that, they're lucky if they can cut 30%.
So based on that, the continued quantitative easing, the printing of money, not being able to reduce the spending as much as everyone is hoping, including myself, from a market investment standpoint, where would you put your money?
That's a good question.
$1 million question.
I wish I knew. One thing, 50 years or so, I buy every month some gold.
Mm-hmm.
I own some gold. I also own some shares, some stocks, mostly outside the U.S. I don't want to go into the details, but I think as a foreigner, it may be better not to have too much money in America. And I own the shares. I'm a value investor. In other words, what interests me is when an industry is depressed or out of favor, say, what is out of favor at the present time compared to, say, 5 years ago? China. Everybody hates China. And they think that the real estate market is so bad. And they seem to think that people only produce in China because labor is cheap. This is all nonsense. As we've seen in many technologies, they're way ahead of Europe and the US in many, not just one. But it's logical. China has the agencies, they measure what the highest qualities universities are in science, in mathematics, in physics, in engineering. China is in the top 10 in most surveys. They have maybe 6 of the top 10 universities. And then the media in the Western world, they tell the people, oh, the Chinese, they don't know anything, but they have cheap labor. I mean, Tim Cox of Apple, he said, it's nonsense. We go to China because of their knowledge. They produce 500,000 students in science and technologies yearly, every year.
Apple and Nike, they also want access to their markets as well so that they can increase
sales. Yes, of course. Yeah. Yes, of course. But this is another point. A Chinese company that is successful, they have such a huge domestic market. You know, it's more than 1 billion people. It's a big market. They can go into a country and afford to lose money for 3 years until they eliminate the competition.
Mm-hmm.
I tell you, I mean, in 10 years' time, there will be many Chinese brands throughout the world. Many Chinese brands.
We're starting to see it now already.
Yes, of course. Yes. In countries where they allow the products in without huge tariffs, you can see it. You can see Chinese construction companies all over the world building dams and building tunnels and building roads and so forth. And then the Western media goes and says, oh, they need to build it at whatever it is in Laos and Cambodia. To this, I respond, yes, better build something than carpet bomb these countries.
Well, the Chinese definitely
that's the
do
reality.
A much better job
that of playing
is
the reality. The media doesn't tell that to the people in America. But the reality is the Americans carpet bombed Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. And now the Chinese are building trains. There are also some disadvantages in economic development. But the fact is they're not carpet bombing the whole country. That has then the result that still some children are born with horrible defects. Horrible defects.
Well, China is definitely playing the long game. President for life versus a rotating every 4 or as much as 8 years. And building that infrastructure for these countries gives them the ability to not only have access to the markets, but also all the natural resources. So they're being very, very smart. They really are. Well, Dr. Faber, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. I think the listeners are really going to enjoy your insight on global economics and politics, because you really do give a different perspective. So I thank you very much.
I want to say this. I mean, we all don't know, because the geopolitical situation at the present time is very tense. And our friends who are very close to the State Department in America, and they are well informed, and others are also equally well informed through reading extensively about the geopolitics in the Middle East. They think that shortly the US and Israel will attack Iran. What the reaction will be, who knows? Because Iran is a member of BRICS that include China, Russia, India, Brazil, and so forth. And I can tell you, the tariffs that Trump implements creates a lot of animosity, a lot.
Well, you're right. If that does happen, that it is. It's going to be have a huge negative effect, not only on the U.S., but the global economy all the way around. So who knows what the future...
Who knows?
Yes, that is true.
And as you say, you know, it is very difficult to know what to invest in. I have a diversified portfolio of stocks, bonds, cash, precious metals, and other commodities, and real estate. And I diversify internationally. But I'm not sure. People have been talking about re-rating constantly. I think there will be a re-rating of assets on the downside. And if everything collapses by 80% or 50%, if you're down only 20%, you're lucky.
Yeah. Well, let's hope we don't have another 2007, 2008, and 2009. But again, we just don't know what the future holds.
But I guarantee that you'll have it worse than 2007 to 2009. It was a kindergarten party.
Well, I've actually heard that from several people, and let's hope that that definitely does not come to fruition, right?
We have to give our sense of humor and have a beer on that. Cheers.
Cheers. Dr. Faber, bye-bye. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You tested your fitness level, not your workout routine. I'm talking about your financial endurance, because if saving to a 401k is the extent of your effort, it is time for you to start shaping up. And Ed Sedell is here to help you do that with The Retirement Trainer. It's his podcast to help you examine your financial stamina and learn the questions you should be asking and areas to focus on to help you get to that place you've been working so hard for, a happy, comfortable retirement. And it's not as hard as some might have made you believe. Ed's broken it down into 5 simple steps. It's The Retirement Fitness Plan, which he personally created to help clarify key areas of your financial life. Learn more about The Retirement Fitness Plan at egsifinancial.com. Then subscribe, follow, and listen to The Retirement Trainer on Apple Podcasts, your iHeart app, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. Investment advisory services offered through EGSI Investment Management, DBA EGSI Financial Group, a registered investment advisor. Insurance and annuities offered through EGSI Financial Services, Inc., Ohio License Number 102-0619.